A king invited all the nobility of his kingdom to a great banquet in celebration of his oldest son. And when the day for the feast came, the king sent his servants out to bring in all the invited guests. And the rich and powerful of the kingdom disagreed with the king's policies. They refused to give him any show of support, and they would attend nothing sponsored by him. So the king sent out more servants to plead with them. And the king instructed his servants to tell them of the extravagant feast that was planned. The lobster was fresh. The filet mignon was tender and juicy. The caviar had arrived that afternoon by plane from Russia. The pastry table was groaning under the weight of the cakes and the donuts and the muffins and the cupcakes and the pies and the puddings and all of the goodies on it. But despite the king's elaborate preparation and gracious invitation, the invited guests were not interested. Some of them ignored the servants, but some of them responded with violence. They grabbed hold of the king's servants. They mocked them, beat them, and then murdered them. And when the king learned what had happened, he was furious. He called his generals to him, and he ordered his armies to wipe out all of those murderous nobles. And so the king's army descended on the troublemakers, killed all of those who had mistreated the king's men, and burned their city to the ground. In the meantime, the king sent his servants to find guests for his feast. The servants brought in everyone that they could find, regardless of wealth or station. And the banquet was filled with people ready to celebrate the king's son. Once the feast was underway, the king came into the banquet hall to see all of the guests. And he found one guest there wearing torn and filthy clothing. And so the king asked him, "Friend, why did you attend my banquet dressed like that?" The poorly dressed man had no defense for his behavior. And so the king commanded his servants to shackle the man's hands and feet, to cast him out of the feast, and to imprison him. Now the parable in Matthew 22 verses 1 through 14 is the third and final parable in a series told in response to the priest and Pharisees' rejection of Jesus and their challenge of his authority. At the end of this parable, the Pharisees begin to plot ways to trap Jesus in his words. And so there followed several doctrinal sparring matches between Jesus and henchmen sent by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And after that, Jesus preached the strongest sermon in the Gospels. That sermon is found in Matthew 23, and in it, Jesus just simply denounces the rulers of Israel, the religious rulers of Israel. In Matthew 24 and 25 is what's called Jesus' Olivet Discourse. In that, he tells of his second coming when he will judge the wicked. In Matthew 26, Jesus is betrayed. And in Matthew 27, Jesus is crucified. So these three parables here in Matthew 21 and 22 are part of this climactic final conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders of Israel. And he's addressing these three parables directly to them. And so as I read Matthew 22, 1 through 14, keep that unbelief of the religious leaders and their hatred of Jesus in the front of your mind. So Matthew 22, verse 1, Jesus answered and spoke to them again by parables and said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. Again, he sent out other servants, saying, 'Tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding.' But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king heard about it, he was furious, and he sent out his armies, destroyed those murderers, and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, 'The wedding is ready, But those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. So he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot, take him away, and cast him into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen." Now those of you who have been following along with this series and the parables, you may remember that this particular parable is incredibly similar to the parable of the Great Supper in Luke 14. We studied the parable of the Great Supper back in August. But in both of these parables, we read of a feast prepared, of invitations rejected, and of others invited instead. However, these are not the same parables. Jesus often repeated themes and teachings in different places and in different times. Remember, he was an itinerant teacher. He went from town to town to town. He didn't come up with something new every place he went. He taught much the same thing in the various places. And we know in the scriptures, for example, that he preached the Beatitudes twice, two different places, two different times. He did the same with the Lord's Prayer. He taught it in two different occasions. And so the parable of the Great Supper in Luke 14 was taught earlier in Jesus' ministry. And we know from Luke 14, it was taught while Jesus was eating at the house of a Pharisee. The parable of the wedding feast here in Matthew 22 was taught in the temple courtyard during the final week of Jesus' public ministry. It's two different parables. And they're similar, but these differences between them really are very important, and they illustrate for us the escalating intensity of Jesus' warnings to the Pharisees. So in Matthew 22, the one giving a feast is not a king, is a king, not a homeowner. In Luke 14, he doesn't tell us the occasion of the feast. Matthew 22 tells us the feast was a wedding feast, given for the king's son. And so that occasion raises the stakes. The rejection of the invitation would dishonor the king and would risk his wrath. It would be an insult to the king. It was a shameful despising of the king's son. But despite the consequences, the ones invited to the wedding feast refused to attend. But after they refused, the king sent his servants back to persuade them to attend. And he instructs them in verse 4 to tell those who are invited, "I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed." Now, those multiple animals prepares indicates this was a massive feast. One fatted calf would probably feed a few hundred people. And so multiple fatted calves plus plural oxen was more than enough to feed over 1,000 people. This was an extravagant feast fit for a king. And the king very graciously invited many to come and to attend. And we get down to verse 5, and really the climax of the first part of this parable, they hear this second invitation. And some of them scorned it. They made light of it. One went out to his fields to tend his farm. Another went to a shop in town. Both of them did not care at all about the king's feast. They were just going to go about their lives, go about their business like the feast was not even happening. The rest, though, verse 6, responded to the king's invitation with violence. They kidnapped the king's servants. It says they treated them spitefully. It's both mock them and abuse them. That there's both verbal and physical violence done to them. And then they killed them. And this mistreatment of the king's servant was an attack against the king himself. If you remember anything about world history at all, what you do to the king's servant, the king takes very personally. You have done it to him. And this is not just they neglect the honor that's given to them. This is contempt for the king. This is essentially saying we want to kill our king. We can't quite reach him, but we want to kill him. It was hateful scorn. It was open rebellion and violent insurrection. Again, think through what you remember of world history. How would the typical dictator respond to such revolting circumstances? Exactly, like the king in this parable. The king in this parable sent his armies to kill everyone who rejected his invitation and to burn their city to the ground. The king required total destruction of the rebels and their city. And you may think that's extreme. You may think Jesus is somewhat exaggerating here. But do you remember? I'm sorry, I'm going to stretch your mind here in history this morning. But do you remember Sherman's march to the coast during the Civil War? He went through the city of Atlanta. He burned Atlanta's industrial city. He destroyed nearly half of that city. You remember the attack, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those two cities were nearly wiped out by atomic bombs. And those three examples are modern, and they did not involve conquerors who had an agenda to punish the people of the city. And in both those cases, they were trying to stop a war as quickly as possible. And they were willing to destroy entire cities to accomplish their goals. But total destruction of cities is not something that we invented in the 20th century. It's been happening for a very long time. The city of Tyre, for example, is a powerful port city which resisted Alexander the Great. He laid siege to the city, and after 7 months, his army completely destroyed it. To the ground, just destroyed it. When Rome conquered Carthage, they killed half the population of that city, over 60,000 people. And they intentionally demolished the entire city. They made sure it was nothing but rubble. And they even plowed up the ground and then sowed it with salt. As just a final insult to say, this city is gone and we want nothing to ever be here again. And so the people who first heard this parable would have thought the complete destruction of a city pretty typical action for a king. It wouldn't have been that surprising. But I think in this context, Jesus' reference to a destroyed city is very suggestive. Luke chapter 19 is talking about the same period of time as Matthew 20, 21, and 22. He's talking about that day in which Jesus went into the temple and this conflict with the priest and the Pharisees. But Luke 19 tells us that when Jesus was entering Jerusalem that morning, he wept over the city and its rejection of him. And then he prophesied. He said, the days will come when your enemies will surround you and dash you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone upon another in you. And Jesus prophesied that Jerusalem would be completely destroyed. And the reference in this parable to a city's total destruction echoes what Jesus had prophesied earlier that morning. And this parable, I believe, is a foreshadowing of the tragedy of 70 AD. In that year, the Roman armies completely destroyed the city of Jerusalem. They tore down its walls and they burned the city to the ground. 500,000 Jews died in the siege and the conquest of Jerusalem. And what Jesus, I think, is pointing to here, he's already referred to in the previous parable, but what Jesus is pointing to here is that the Israelites had rebelled against their God. They had killed his son. And God the king is going to punish the nation with destruction and death. As we saw last week, the Jews were losing their status of being God's chosen people. And now Jesus is warning their most important city is going to be destroyed. But again, as I mentioned last week, this period of loss and judgment is temporary. God will restore Israel as His chosen people. God will establish the Israelites in their land. He will make them a great nation. He will reign over the world from Jerusalem. Now, all of that is right after verse 6. Obviously, Jesus didn't stop to explain His words. He just continued with the parable. And when he moves immediately into the second act of this parable. So this parable really has two acts. Each act has three scenes. In the first scene of the first act, invitations are sent out. The second scene, depicts the responses to the invitations. And then the third scene, judgment is executed. The second act follows that same sequence. So then the scene one, the king sends his servants back out to invite whoever will come. They were not to be choosy with the invitations. He says, you go out in the highways and as many as you find, verse 9, as many as you can find, invite to the wedding. All were invited. In the second scene, we find that many respond. Verse 10, the servants went out, gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. But the second scene zooms in on one character. And it tells us of this one man who responded to the invitation. He attended the feast, but he was not properly clothed for a wedding feast. Now, we actually don't know what he was wearing. Even though I started my story at the beginning of the sermon, I mentioned filthy, torn clothes. He probably wasn't wearing just rags, but he was not wearing festal attire. He was not wearing what was expected to be worn at a wedding feast. And his failure to do so was not treated as just a little oversight. Culturally, that would have been seen as an insult to the groom, the bride, and the groom's father. So this is him thumbing his nose at the king and the king's son. And so because of the man's improper response to the invitation, this third scene of the second act of this parable is also a scene of judgment. The king commanded the man be bound and throw out of the feast into outer darkness. And Jesus says where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. In this parable, we read a warning of severe judgment on Israel for its insult to God's Son and insurrection against His rule. Remember, there's three parables here together. And we have to read them in light of one another. In the previous parable, we read a warning that the blessings of being God's chosen people would be taken from Israel and given to another nation. In this parable, we learn the invitation to enjoy God's blessing is given to all people without discrimination. But we also read in this parable a warning against presumption upon the graciousness of the invitation. So the openness of the invitation does not mean that God accepts all who come to Him any way they choose. God invites all to come to Him and requires that they come to Him clothed properly. Now, I need to address a couple difficult points in this parable before I discuss what the well-dressed person will wear in heaven. And so let me deal with some of these side issues real quick and before we come back to that. There are some who have used this parable as a proof that a person can lose his salvation. So they read the wedding feast as speaking about heaven or maybe the millennial kingdom. And because of that, they assume anyone in the feast must be saved. Obviously, you're not going to go to heaven if you're not saved. So if the feast is heaven, he's there, he must be saved, and then he's cast out. If he can be cast out of the feast, then he must have lost his salvation. And that's the basic argument that's laid out. But there are two things in this text that make that interpretation impossible. First, remember this parable comes in the context of Jesus' warning to Israel for her rejection of Him. So the issue at stake is first Israel's lost status as the people of God, not salvation. Now, that may sound a little bit confusing. Aren't they the same thing? Actually, at this time in history, they were not. All Israelites, obedient to the law of Moses, were part of the people of God, even if they were not saved. Their status as chosen people of God on earth was not the same as their salvation. So there were many Jews who throughout history that enjoyed the blessings of being part of God's chosen nation who did not also have eternal life, because salvation has always been and only been through faith in God's promise to send a deliverer. Those Jews who kept the laws and kept the sacrifices but were not trusting God to send one to forgive their sin were not saved. They enjoyed the blessings in the nation and the land, but they did not have salvation. And so all three of these parables is about Israel's national loss of status as the chosen people of God because they rejected God's prophets, God's Word, and God's Son. These parables are actually not primarily about salvation. So we cannot read the wedding feast as heaven or the millennial kingdom. We cannot read it as a picture of salvation. Therefore, we cannot read this about as if this man is losing salvation. Rather, he was simply a member of the visible people of God, if you want to say it that way. And I'll also remind you that details of parables should never be pushed beyond their immediate purpose. We've talked about this in the past. If a detail is just background, then it should stay in the background. If a detail has significance, its significance and meaning must be limited to the intent of its use in the parable. So that in this parable, the wedding feast is a picture of those who have professed reception of God's invitation. So being in the wedding feast signifies being a visible part of the chosen people of God. The wedding feast is not a picture of salvation or of heaven. It is the picture of the visible people of God. First, it was the kingdom of Israel that was the visible people of God. When they refused God's invitation, that status was given to others who have become the new people of God. That new people of God is the church. And this parable warns that someone can be part of the visible church and can profess to be a Christian without being saved. Those who are part of visible Christianity but are not saved are like this improperly dressed man at the wedding feast. That was issue one. Issue two is the cryptic statement at the end, verse 14. For many are called, but few are chosen. The first issue is, what is he saying? What does he even mean by that? And the second issue related to that is that some read this line as teaching the doctrine of unconditional election. And so as I answer that, I think I'll help us understand the phrase itself as well. But the doctrine of unconditional election teaches in eternity, before God created anything, God determined to save specific individuals. And the ones God elected to save will be saved. The ones God did not elect to save will not be saved. Now, this morning, I'm not going to comment on that doctrine specifically. That subject is way too large. I don't have time for that this morning. But instead, I want to comment just on this single verse and simply say verse 14 does not teach anything about election. It just doesn't teach about election. If it does teach anything, if you're going to read anything, draw anything from it about election, it teaches that becoming elect is the result of a person's reception of Jesus. You can't actually read this and say this is talking about elect before time began. The context is very much elect based upon somebody's receiving of the invitation. Let me go back and explain that. Look up in verse 3. The king sent out his servants to call. That word call is a major theme, major feature in this parable. It starts right at, really almost at the very beginning of the parable, we bump into it. At the very end of the parable, we bump into it. At the same time, we see it repeated throughout this parable. And our English translations obscure this a little bit, but Jesus uses that same word several times. So the word call in verse 3 is the root word of called in verse 14. The word invited shares that same root. Call is the root of invited. So if you will, the king sent out his servants to call those called. That's what he's saying. We see it again down in verse 8. The wedding is ready, but those who were called are not worthy. Verse 9, go out in the highways and as many as you can find, call to the wedding. Five times in this parable, we have reference to the called or the calling. And so when Jesus says many are called, he's using that same word. Many have been invited. Who's been invited? Well, everyone. I mean, that's what he tells us in verse 10, verse 9, as many as you find, invite to the wedding. Who's called? All of them. So who's chosen? Well, the parable doesn't use that word until verse 14. But it certainly describes those who are chosen, or those who are not chosen, I should say. Those in the parable who rejected the invitation of the king were judged severely. The one who accepted the invitation but did not come properly was also judged severely. The first recipients of the invitation were called, but they were not chosen because they rejected the calling. The poorly dressed man was called, but he was not chosen because he did not come properly. So at the very least, we have to say the chosen are those who accept the invitation and come properly. And when we put this parable in the context of the other two parables in this trilogy, we understand that the chosen are those who believe the messengers of God and submit to the Son of God. To say it another way, the chosen are those who do not reject but receive God's invitation and God's Son. So that in this case, you cannot read chosen as something that happens beforehand. The chosen are those worthy to participate in the wedding feast because they have accepted the invitation, have come properly clothed. Which leads us back to the question of what's the proper clothing for the wedding feast. Most cultures expect guests at a wedding to wear a certain type of clothing. The cultures of the first century Roman Empire certainly had expectations of their wedding guests. And as I've already said, to not meet those expectations was viewed as an insult to the ones getting married. And that was true in first century Judea. It was true in this parable. And so this man's careless dress was an insult to the king and the king's son. Consequently, he was punished severely for his disrespect. Now, if we are to press this analogy of the parable to the very edge of what I think we can get away with, the clothing which God requires of all who would have his favor is simply the righteousness of Christ. Isaiah 61 verse 10 says, I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 tells us that God made Jesus to be sin for us, even though Jesus knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. So the clothing that is required is simply the righteousness of Christ. It's certainly not the robes of your own righteousness. Isaiah 64:6 is a vivid picture. It says, all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. All of our righteousness that we may be tempted to bring to God and say, see, this is good clothing for this wedding. It's that nasty, greasy rag that's been lying on my garage floor and has been sucking up transmission fluid and motor oil, and I've wiped my hands on it, and everything else under the sun is on that rag. And I bring it and say, see, isn't this pretty? And it's filthy. Titus chapter 3 says, not by works of righteousness which we have done. Our righteousness is of no value to God. When we come to God with our own righteousness, we come in our old rags, not fitting attire for a wedding feast, so that all who come to Him in their own righteousness will be cast out. But those who come dressed in the righteousness of Jesus, they will have a place in the great marriage supper of the Lamb. They will have a place in heaven. The only way to have that place is to come to Him in the manner He requires and through the means He has provided. God requires you to come through faith in Jesus. He has provided salvation fully and only through His own Son. He has promised to receive all who come to Him through Jesus, so that as many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become the children of God, even to as many as believe on His name. So that if you have received Jesus, you have God's favor, and you will be welcomed into heaven by Him. If you are not trusting Jesus and Jesus alone as your complete salvation, if you're trying to present your own works to God as sufficient, not only is it not acceptable, it is insulting as the poorly dressed man in the wedding. If you come trusting Him, you will be received. If you do not believe Him, if you are not trusting Jesus, then you're not received and will not be received. And being a good Christian does not save. Being a member of a church or a faithful attender at a church does not save. Doing good works does not save. Performing religious rituals does not save. Only relying fully upon Jesus as your Savior brings salvation. If you've not done that, my plea is that you will turn to Christ and trust Him alone. Then as we wrap up, I want to just say to you who are saved, take note of the reality of God's judgment. Time doesn't allow us to delve into this, but that destroyed city in this parable became a reality when Rome destroyed Jerusalem. That place of outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth is also a reality. God is merciful. God gives people time and space to repent. He gives opportunity after opportunity to believe. However, the day will come when no more opportunity will be given. The day will come when the unsaved are cast into judgment, and then they will be separated forever from the mercy and grace of God. They will be cast into a place of deep anguish and agony. And we must consider the horrible reality of the eternal condition of the lost. Their need should break our hearts. We should pray earnestly for their salvation. Because none are saved unless God first works in their heart to convict of sin, give understanding of the gospel, and draw the sinner to Himself. The obligation that we have as saved people is to tell them the gospel and to pray fervently for their salvation. And I imagine, I'm pretty confident that every one of you here is close friends or close family with at least one person who is not saved. You may know their name. Their name may have already popped into your head as soon as I said that. Do you pray for that person's salvation? How often do you pray for them to be saved? Do you do more than just mention them in prayer? Certainly there are times where we just can only mention them. We have other things that are weighing on our heart. But do you ever plead their case before God? Do you go to Him and plead God's glory and God's promises for their salvation? Consider the eternal fate awaiting the lost. Let the possibility of that future anguish stir you to pray with passion, intensity, and fervor for their salvation.